This is the View from Apollo podcast, an ongoing conversation on alternative investing, economics, and the trends shaping up financial markets.
The economy is strong, but real estate is underperforming. That's an extremely rare and maybe unprecedented scenario for the U.S. real estate market. In this episode of The View from Apollo, Apollo partner Randy Anderson talks to chief economist Torsten Slok about how rising interest rates contributed to these unusual conditions and what a higher-for-longer rate environment could mean for real estate going forward.
Real estate prices, though, have really already adjusted to this sort of new interest rate regime. So if real estate saw interest rates fall, not only would you get good income returns, you would get hyper or accelerated appreciation. If rates don't really fall, you can still get a nice, good quality income return and modest appreciation in those environments.
In a wide-ranging conversation, Randy assesses current conditions across public and private real estate markets and makes the case that there are attractive opportunities to be found in both debt and equity, as long as prices and structures can be adjusted to today's market realities. So, without any further ado, let's get started.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Torsten Slok, Chief Economist at Apollo, and you're listening to the View from Apollo podcast. My guest today is Randy Anderson, a partner in the Real Assets Group here at Apollo. Randy invests and has great insights in all areas of the real estate market, including both public and private real estate. Today, he's here to share his thoughts on how recent performance in the real estate market is actually quite unique in historical terms, and to discuss his views on what's next in terms of market direction and potential opportunities. Randy, it's a real pleasure to have you here on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Well, Torsten, it's really great to be here. I'm excited to spend a little time with you.
Oh, that's fantastic. So I'd like to start with something that you told me recently about how the real estate markets we are experiencing today represents something of an aberration in historical terms. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a very unusual time. Actually, I would say it's an unprecedented time. So in the U.S., we started keeping track of real estate data back in the 70s. And you can look at something called the NCREIF data, if you will. And they kept track of institutional data. It was primarily in the main sectors of office, industrial, you know, retail, and multifamily. And if you stop the clock from the 70s at 2019, there'd only been four down periods, only four. And the interesting thing about those four down periods is that every one of them was affiliated or associated with a recession, every one of them. And in fact, there were recessions where there wasn't even a real estate downturn. So it was a necessary but not sufficient condition for the real estate markets to turn in the other direction. And we also had a situation where fundamentals fell apart because obviously in a recession, there was poor demand. So we didn't really have a demand side. And also a lot of building was happening ahead of time. You got no demand and excess supply coming to the market. Well, then all of a sudden the pandemic hit. Well, we've now had seven quarters of negative real estate appreciations or depreciation, if you will, happening. And so we're over 2 years rolling in, you know, going to 2 years and perhaps even a third year of where real estate has been struggling and we haven't had a recession. So it's a very interesting time. And not only have we not had a recession across most of the asset classes, you know, albeit problems in the office sector, which we can talk about later, the fundamentals remain very strong.
So what you're saying is that it is quite unusual to have had this extended run of negative returns, and it is entirely unprecedented to have these types of returns at a time when the economy is not in a recession, but it's actually quite strong. If that's right, can you talk about what has caused these unusual market conditions?
Yeah, it's really what happened with monetary policy. So, you know, you think about buying assets in an interest rate environment, which is basically zero. Cap rates really came down. I'll just give a simple example almost illustrates the point the best. Let's suppose that you bought a building, you know, even a couple years ago, and you had fixed rate financing on it. Say it's a multifamily property. If you happen to be in a good market, your cash flow today may be higher than your cash flow yesterday if you had fixed rate financing on it or you had no financing on it. In other words, the supply was small, the demand was high. But the problem is, Torsten, if I own that building, I might be happy if I'm not trying to sell it. But if I needed to sell that building to you, well, you can't go finance it with my low cost of debt. You might have to go put on a 6.5% fixed mortgage or a 7 or 8%, you know, floating rate mortgage on it. So when you think about the value of it or the discounted cash flows of it to a new buyer or what the real actual fundamental market value is, it's much lower today because of that change, if you will, in interest rate environments.
Well, that makes perfect sense. It also raises the question, I mean, what happens if these conditions continue? It now seems pretty clear that the Fed will not cut interest rates, at least in the near term. We've been saying that they may not even cut interest rates this year. And they would likely, therefore, should be planning with a higher for longer scenario when it comes to interest rates. And meanwhile, we at Apollo are not predicting a recession. To the contrary, it seems that the economy will remain strong, which is what we've been arguing for now quite some time. So again, that leads us to the question, what happens in the real estate market if we see this no landing scenario in which rates remain higher and the economy remains strong?
Well, Torsten, that's a really good question. You know, the truth is, anytime you have a strong economy, that's important. If you get GDP growth, it leads to job growth, which generally leads to an increase in demand. And at a higher rate, a lot of development deals really won't pencil out. So that should keep supply in check. So fundamentals will be in a good shape. Real estate prices, though, have really already adjusted to this sort of new interest rate regime. So if real estate saw interest rates fall, not only would you get good income returns, you would get hyper or accelerated appreciation. If rates don't really fall, you can still get a nice, good quality income return and modest appreciation in those environments. On the other hand, you can go to the lending side of the balance sheet and say, great, we've got good fundamentals. We probably have still less people lending than we had before. You can lend at a higher rate to better sponsors with more equity sitting in those positions. And again, there's other parts of the market. We can talk about the public market, for example, that is not only priced in sort of higher for longer, but if overpriced in higher for longer, if you would sort of think about it in that manner.
Well, that's really interesting. So with that backdrop, turning to looking at it from an investing angle, are there attractive opportunities available amid these historically unusual conditions?
Yeah, I think there are a lot. I mean, you know, certainly over the last year and continuing through today, being a real estate lender is a quite interesting deal. If you go back and think about, you know, a first rate fixed loan back in 2018 or 2019, not that exciting. You might be able to lend at 3%. But today, you might be looking at a 6.5% to 9% loan, depending on whether it's fixed or floating, depending on what asset class, depending on where you are from an LTV point of view. And that's quite attractive when you're sitting with quite a bit of equity sitting above it. In fact, you got to go back a long time to find opportunities where being a real estate lender has been more attractive. And you always want to be a supplier of capital in a market that's scarce of capital. You know, on the equity side, we also have this situation that's quite interesting. So what deals are coming to the market? Well, first of all, not that many. Transaction volume still slow, albeit maybe we're seeing a moderate pickup. But what happens is that real estate people might have 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, depending how big you are, properties for sale. And all of a sudden, financing comes due. Maybe you have 50%, maybe you have 60%, maybe you have 70% leverage to refinance it. You're refinancing that property at a lower LTV because prices came down because of cap rates. The new debt you have to put on it has higher rates on it, and you may not be able to feed all the extra equity that you need into those deals. So people that own some of that real estate have to push that real estate to the market. And if you have dry powder and you have capital, you can buy high quality real estate that just has a structure issue, not really a problem with supply and demand, and get outsized or very attractive returns if you have liquidity in this marketplace.
Yeah, very interesting. And you and I talk about this often. And last time we spoke, you were in general favoring debt over equity. So given what you just said, that's still true, or has your perspective changed?
Well, I think it's true in general. There's more opportunities on the debt side, but we are seeing in the marketplace, as you look around, you see deals, you see cap rates that have adjusted enough in markets where the NOI growth is sufficient enough to where you're starting to see the premium that you need to make an equity investment pencil out. So if you're looking at a deal that's doing, let's say, an 8 or a 9, you probably need 300 basis points of excess return to go into a first loss position. And there certainly are deals that are starting to make sense in that regard today as people are becoming convinced that we have rates a little bit higher for a little bit longer, or they simply just have capital needs and we're getting used to what the market reality is. And people believe that rates aren't going to go back to zero again. And so people are having to transact and come to where the market is.
Well, so let's dive a little bit deeper into the investment implications, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I know that you invest across debt and equity, as well as private and public real estate. So you are really flexible in your investment approach. So with that in mind, can you take us through how you view the relative value across real estate markets today?
Sure. One of the interesting things about real estate is that you can be a low-risk, low-return investor. You can be a high-risk, high-return investor, and you certainly can take different approaches at different times. And, you know, if you look across all the cycles, there's almost always one or two of the four quadrants, if you will, that makes sense to lean into. So today, interestingly, the public market represents obviously a pretty good opportunity to invest. It's a very, very small sector. It's very interest rate sensitive. It's one of the smaller GIC sectors, if you will, in the S&P 500. It's been beat up pretty badly. So if you think about why it's been beat up badly, well, in 2018, everything kind of sold off. It got caught up in equity beta, just like everything else did. Then 2020 came along, the equity markets ripped and REITs didn't. You know, there were still a lot of headlines that nobody was going to leave their house during the pandemic, or there'd be another lockdown and you wouldn't go shopping again, or you wouldn't go back to the mall and offices were going to be closed. And so it struggled then. But then, of course, when the Fed actually did start to tighten down monetary policy, it probably sold off and sold off for the right reason. But REITs really never sell off sort of exactly the right amount. They certainly are directionally correct. So when interest rates go up, they went down, and they went down, but they always overshoot. So not only do they go down to NAV and kind of meet the market, they sold to the point where they're trading below net asset value, meaning that the value, let's say, of a portfolio might be 100, but the price could be, you know, 80. So anytime you can buy $100 worth of something for 80 over a long period of time, you tend to do pretty well. And in fact, following Fed rate cuts, REITs tend to outperform the broader markets. REITs tend to perform very well when interest rates move down. And historically, it's been one of the better performing sectors in the marketplace. We like that opportunity. Certainly in private real estate, we really like several sectors. Some of them are mainstream. We think that industrial is doing really well. Obviously, it's been well talked about with the last mile. By the time we're done with this podcast, Torsten, one of us are going to have a package sitting on our porch at home.
So true.
We certainly have different pockets of the housing market that's going to make sense, whether it's multifamily or student housing. And certainly necessity retail is doing a really good job. In fact, we have more sales per square foot today than we did pre-pandemic. And as we've mentioned, of course, we like being a real estate lender. And again, depending on where you want to be in the risk return side of the debt market, you know, there's some really good opportunities there. Spreads have tightened. It was an amazing opportunity. It's still a good opportunity, but you got to play that spot depending on where you want to sit along the risk return frontier.
So when people talk about that the commercial real estate has been facing some headwinds as a result of rates higher, I'm sure you think in a much more nuanced way in terms of commercial real estate as a much broader concept, and there's a lot of subcomponents, including industrials, as you just mentioned. So when you look across the commercial real estate spectrum at the moment, I'm sure you see both opportunities and you see both tailwinds and headwinds. Can you maybe talk about what parts of commercial real estate that you think are interesting at the moment?
In real estate today, you just can't go out there and grab anything and expect a good return. If you went back to 2014 and you bought anything in, say, a market like Nashville, or you bought anything in Austin, or quite frankly, anything in the Sun Belt, you made money because a rising tide sort of floated all boats. But some of those markets got overbuilt. Some of those markets aren't the best markets to be in. In fact, you know, New York City got beat up, and somebody would have told you during the pandemic that no one should ever make an investment in multifamily in New York again. But honestly, that market's tightened up and rents have really come back as some of the work from home has faded a little bit. And there was some pricing pressure. So I think in this market today, you got to be real forward looking, looking at where the jobs are going, looking how people are using space. And if you follow fundamentally where the right demand is going, generally speaking, you end up in a good spot. So we're really checking those things and looking forward.
All right. So there's a lot of discussion about office at the moment, both with more people working from home and interest rates have gone up. And often this is characterized as everything in commercial real estate is in trouble. But Randy, how do you look at office and the other sectors, multifamily, industrial, retail? What is, in your view, the overall situation when you have this backdrop of rates higher for longer for commercial real estate, especially with this discussion that is so pronounced at the moment about office being challenged?
Boy, I tell you, the whole office headline has really hit not just office, but it's hit sentiment across the entire real estate market. It's funny, to some degree, every time I read an article that real estate's the next shoe to drop, 90 out of 10 times, it's that there was a bad office deal. You know, somebody had an over-leveraged office building, the leverage came due, and vacancy went up. Listen, office is having a lot of trouble. Let me give you a little backdrop. You're talking to a person who's fundamentally not liked office for 20 years, and it's really data-based. You know, when people typically underwrite office, they assume either a 5 or a 10% vacancy rate. But the truth is the average vacancy rate even before this sort of work from home was around 12. So you're already assuming there's more people in the building than there is over time. The second thing, they underwrite a certain level of capital expenditures. And almost in all cases, that level is understated. So now you've got more revenue than you think, and you got more costs than you think. It leads to underperformance. So office historically has had the worst risk-adjusted return over long periods of time than the other asset classes just in general. So in general, across portfolios, I've always been a proponent to underweight it. Now, it can be a great trade, meaning that in an office market in the old days, it used to be the case that vacancy would get to 20, nobody would build. It would get to 15, nobody would build. It would get to 10 and people would start to build, but it takes 5 years to deliver an office building. And all of a sudden you're down to no vacancy and you get these giant rent pops and these giant valuation increases and people make money. And that's where people generally typically have come and said, hey, let's do an office opportunity fund and we can make a lot of money. Well, today I think it's much more challenging because in those days, the only problem with office was the economy was bad and we had supply overhang. Today, it's unclear what value is. It's unclear how long it's going to take to absorb that office because we don't know what the new dynamic will be from a work from home. How many people will come back to work? What's going to be the percentage? I certainly think it'll be more than we currently stand today, but it's really hard to get an idea of value. More importantly, even if you pick the value correctly, a lot of things that people talk about are hard to do. You know, you think about, you know, Torsten, you think about this building, and there's a couple of, you know, of restroom facilities where the plumbing's in. Are we going to turn this whole thing into a multifamily? We've got to change the plumbing out everywhere. Pretty expensive, almost in some cases impossible or cost prohibitive to do. Or let's say that's not even the problem. We're going to keep it as office. Well, if this building was 50% vacant and a tenant came in, you're giving that tenant free rent. But you still got to pay the broker a big commission. They may say, hey, I need to change the color of the carpet. I need to change the office design. All those things are very expensive. So while you're waiting for vacancy to get down and returns to pop, you bleed cash. So historically, it's been the buyer of the opportunistic buyer that ends up making money in office in a lot of cases. So I think it's going to be a while before that's somewhere that you can really lean in either own or rent. But, you know, you asked me a question about, you know, sort of relative value and what does that mean for some of the other asset classes. I think it's really interesting. I think that people have a recency bias and kind of forget where we were. You know, I'm first going to use a stock market example and then I'll come back to the real estate market. So, you know, Torsten, how many GIC sectors do we have? And we got quite a few GIC sectors out there. So every year there's one or two or more of those GIC sectors that are in bad shape. They're overvalued or a couple of the big constituents don't do well. And you have a negative GIC sector in the S&P 500. However, that doesn't necessarily mean it's bad to invest in the S&P 500. We've seen those things happen. Let's say energy's way down. It doesn't mean that you didn't have a 15 or 20% return in the S&P 500, nor is anybody pulling the money away from it. The corollary in real estate is that it wasn't too long ago that it wasn't office that was the tough word. All the headlines were in retail. And we've had discussions about that, right?
Yep.
You know?
It moves around.
Nobody wanted the big boxes. Nobody, you know.
Now everyone was shopping from home.
Everybody's shopping from home. Nobody's going to go to a
strip
store.
Malls, yeah.
You know, maybe there's one mall that can make it, but the second mall is completely vacant. Yeah. Well, the interesting backdrop around that, we had some conversations, is during some of the worst times in retail where the demand was going away, well, interest rates were low, capital was flowing to it, yields were really attractive relative to other asset classes. Real estate itself had a tremendous run and had some of its best returns ever. So having one sector in a real estate asset portfolio not doing well doesn't mean the whole asset class is uninvestable. And today, there's so many more ways to invest in real estate, whether it's across the quadrants, but there's a whole bunch of new sectors that are emerging. I mean, even think about, you want to invest or be a landlord to the economy that's growing. So things that are growing today, AI is growing. There's going to be a lot of demand for data centers. I don't need to worry about whether a certain stock in that sector is over or undervalued. All I need to know is that there's more and more demand in those sectors, and I want to be a landlord to tenants in those growing sectors. So those types of things make sense. More life sciences make sense. Intersection of biology and technology. So you got to go where those things are. And just because overall office isn't doing well doesn't mean the rest of the economy won't do well, meaning that there won't be demand for real estate in other sectors. Well, that's a little challenging, and it's a little too early to be in that sector.
So turning to broader risks and a broader question of what keeps you awake at night. I mean, if you have the double whammy of interest rates higher for longer and the risk of the economy slowing down, how do you think about risk for real estate in terms of the next several years? What are you watching and what are items on your list in terms of what could go wrong and what could go right?
You know, I think as a good investor, I have the appropriate amount of anxiety. I live my life in the tail. So as you are talking about a scenario, it's a scenario that I worry about all the time. That is the scenario that keeps, I think, anybody who's investing in risk assets up at night. Well, let's suppose that, you know, rates do stay higher for longer and we end up with the economy tanking.
So some version of stagflation.
You've got a situation where the cost of capital is high on a levered asset.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, demand fading as we go into a recession. You can't really undo supply. You can't make less widgets of buildings and apartments and things like this. So you kind of have an inelastic supply curve. We can't just sort of knock buildings down and be back in equilibrium. So certainly that keeps me up at night. You have to make investments always when it's not perfectly clear because things are bottom and bottoming, but you know, no one can ever pick a bottom, but you should take your risk appropriately. So you want to be in sectors, one, that aren't going to be hurt by technology. You want to be in property types that are more secular driven, not GDP growth driven. So, you know, I don't want to have to be in a sector that needs 2-4% GDP growth to still have strong supply and demand fundamentals. So we're looking there. I think it's also very prudent if you're on the equity side to keep your leverage low. I think trying to put a lot of leverage into a situation where your demand could fade and really no cap rate compression, in other words, no value enhancement just through what's happening in the capital markets, I think you want to make sure your leverage is appropriate and maybe even lower than you would be once you get more of the free and clear signal. You can always step on the gas later. You can always add leverage later. And I think it also means that you want to be in places that have already been beaten up, so you've got a little bit more cushion. That could be on the debt side where you've got a little bit more cushion like we talked about, or it could be in the public market that's not only seen problems, but really is priced in a recession. At some level, they've already priced in this sort of higher for longer, no Fed rate cut, and almost a doomsday scenario, not even where the market's traded, but even below that level. So there's more cushion or less value at risk or expected shortfall, if you want to use sort of the financial lingo around it, if you will.
So to summarize that, if the main problems are two things, rates are higher for longer, and the risk is that the economy will slow down, well, rates higher for longer, one way to deal with that is to have less leverage.
Yep.
And if the economy slows down, one way to deal with that is to go after thematic investments such as data centers instead of investments that are cyclically sensitive to whatever GDP and the unemployment rate may be doing. Is that a fair summary?
Well, that's right. I mean, even when you get into the micro sectors, I mean, you know, somebody's got to live somewhere, so maybe some B and C housing could make sense because you need shelter, right? I mean, you know, in a down economy, that tends to do pretty well. I mean, if you're thinking about industrial, well, it's GDP sensitive if you're talking about the ports. It's a little bit less GDP sensitive on stuff that are part of the critical distribution hubs. Maybe you think about different types of healthcare and unregulated sectors where, you know, people are getting older and those demographic changes and shifts are uncorrelated, if you will, to the overall economic growth. But you got to be thinking about things that don't require that GDP growth to create the demand to protect your downside. And quite frankly, if we end up in that scenario, you know, real estate's not going to be alone. I mean, all asset classes will have, for the most part, a challenging time in a scenario where the economy's falling apart in a stagflation kind of economy, high rates, and basically the consumer not doing good, GDP not doing well, and underlying that means that the consumer is struggling as well.
Well, no, and that makes complete sense. If we broaden out the discussion just across all asset classes, yeah, even both in private credit and private equity, if the problem is rates are higher for longer and there's a risk the economy will slow down, the answer is up in quality, go after more thematic investments and make sure that you don't have too much leverage if the risk is that rates will stay high for a very long period.
Yeah, and if you do that, you know, you end up coming out of it a pretty good case. You know, one interesting story I had, you know, back in the day, I was actually working for a company out in the West Coast, and this was before the global financial crisis. And at the time, San Francisco, it's a tough market to invest in today, but for a long time, it was one of the best multifamily markets you could invest in. We're getting awfully worried that we're going to have an economic downturn, and cap rates kept going down and down and down. We were investing in San Francisco. for a while, there was a 400 basis point difference in cap rates between San Francisco and Oakland. So it made sense to go grab some stuff in Oakland because the difference should be about 200 basis points. But all of a sudden, that 400 became 300, and the 300 became 200, and the 200 became 100. This makes no sense. You need to be in the higher quality assets as things are getting riskier. So we dumped all of our exposure in the worst market. And sure, cap rates expanded and values went down in San Francisco by a little. But when the market recovered, they snapped right back. Out in Oakland, not only did they go back to where they were, they got worse and stayed worse. So lower leverage, the better market, less risk allowed you to go down less and recover faster.
Makes complete sense.
All right, so let's pivot to a more general question regarding real estate. You mentioned the pressures on commercial real estate, because in particular, the pressures that have been here now for a little while in office. We've also touched on supply shortages. And nationally, the United States faces a shortage in supply of residential housing. This shortage seems to stem from both under construction as well as folks' unwillingness to give up on existing long-term mortgages with low fixed interest rates. These are big issues that go beyond investment markets and affect both the overall economy and the lives of millions of individuals. So it seems we're in need for some creative solutions. Are policymakers doing anything to address these issues?
Well, there's certainly a lot of proposals underway. You know, I think that through some of the challenges in the pandemic, there's certainly been some issues that have happened in cities and to families throughout the United States. I mean, you think about it for a second. If there's just less housing than there are households, it means we got some issues in place. I mean, you think about even perhaps the American dream. If it is home ownership, well, housing prices really never came down. They just keep going up, and they keep going up, and taxes keep going up, and insurance goes up. That's very difficult to do. And at the same time, it's very hard to make for a developer, multifamily or even single family for rent, pencil out, because inflation has made it so expensive to build. It's really hard to build product at a price point where you can rent to people. So the affordability issue is very difficult. So there's likely, and there is discussion around ways to have public-private partnerships. There's ways to try to think about making mortgages more affordable for people, to provide some other assistance to sort of bridge the gap between the number of housing units that are available and that particular need. Now, way beyond the scope of this podcast, you always want the policymakers to not just play checkers, but to play chess, because with every action comes a reaction. So we certainly need to solve this crisis. There's a lot of socioeconomic issues and a lot of negative consequences of things that have happened. But of course, every time you do something, it potentially creates another problem. So for example, let's say a new family comes to a particular marketplace, and today they've saved and they have no choice but to say buy a house, or maybe because of certain needs that they have. You buy that house and all of a sudden a policy change is made and it leads to a whole new supply in your particular marketplace. Well, maybe all the equity that you saved all of a sudden goes away. So there's always a first derivative and a second derivative move. We need to do something to solve this, but policymakers need to spend a long time thinking about the first derivative, second, and third, so we have a balanced policy that gets housing to the right natural equilibrium and also doesn't create problems or unintended consequences, if you will.
Well, thanks so much, Randy. And we're getting closer to the allotted time here. So I want to just introduce what has become a tradition here on our podcast. We call it a personal recommendation, which is basically a question about what you do when you're not focused on real estate and doing your job. This could be a book you're reading, a movie you've seen, a cultural recommendation, a hobby, anything really. So, Randy, what is your personal recommendation for us?
Well, I'll tell you the first one is, you know, I hit a 56th birthday here a few weeks ago, and in all my years of doing work, I always said, oh, there's no way I can stay in balance. So the thing that I let go was exercise. And the truth is, you don't need to let go of it. I find that you can always find 30 minutes to an hour to do something. So I found a way to lose about 140 pounds over the last couple of years. And my new goal is to, before I turn 60, to have run a race, whether it's a 5K, 10K, half, or a full marathon in every state before I hit 60. And while doing so, I'm also trying to continue learning. So I'm always listening to a book while I'm running. And my latest one is Sapiens, which I've really enjoyed during my podcast. I found it fascinating. Some very interesting things in that regard.
Wow, you're very ambitious also in your spare time, I can hear that. So I also have a personal recommendation, and I was inspired by our good friend here, JP Vicente, who is head of content at Apollo, and he and I talk a lot about different things, but we go to the theater once in a while, and last Sunday I went to see Uncle Vanya, which is a play by Chekhov at the Lincoln Theater here in New York City. And this was also inspired by my daughter, who has been taking Russian literature in her high school. And that was fantastic. That was with Steve Carell. And it was just a really well done play. So thanks very much, JP, for all your inspiration as usual and the discussions we have about what plays are out there that are interesting to look at. So thanks very much again, Randy. It's just been really great to hear your views on the real estate market and how investors can frame the opportunity in this asset class in an environment of higher for longer rates. So thank you so much for talking to us today. And thanks very much, everyone, for listening in.
Thank you, Torsten.
This podcast was recorded on Wednesday, May the 15th, 2024.
Thanks for listening. A quick reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Audible, or by visiting apolloacademy.com, our educational website dedicated to alternative investing, where you can also sign up to have Torsten's Daily Spark economic blog delivered directly to your inbox. Once again, thanks for listening.
Apollo Global Management Incorporated, together with its subsidiaries, Apollo, makes no representation or warranty, expressed or implied, with respect to the accuracy, reasonableness, or completeness of any of the statements made during this podcast, including, but not limited to, statements obtained from third parties. Opinions, estimates, and projections constitute the current judgment of the speaker as of the date indicated. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Apollo and are subject to change at any time without notice. Apollo does not have any responsibility to update this podcast to account for such changes. There can be no assurance that any trends discussed during this podcast will continue. Statements made throughout this podcast are not intended to provide and should not be relied upon for accounting, legal, or tax advice and do not constitute an investment recommendation or investment advice. Investors should make an independent investigation of the information discussed during this podcast, including consulting their tax, legal, accounting, or other advisors about such information. Apollo does not act for you and is not responsible for providing you with the protections afforded to its clients. This podcast does not constitute an offer to sell or the solicitation of an offer to buy any security, product, or service, including interest in any investment product or fund or account managed or advised by Apollo. Certain statements made throughout this podcast may be forward-looking in nature. Due to various risks and uncertainties, actual events or results may differ materially from those reflected or contemplated in such forward-looking information. As such, undue reliance should not be placed on such statements. Forward-looking statements may be identified by the use of terminology including, but not limited to, may, will, should, expect, anticipate, target, project, estimate, intend, continue, or believe, or the negatives thereof, or other variations thereon, or comparable terminology.